Welcome to Sake Deep Dive, the sake podcast for the beyond beginner. I am your host, Jim Ryan, sake author, translator, and bird watcher. Joined as always by my friend and co-host, Andrew Russell. How are you doing, Andrew?
Good, bird watcher. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Seeing some good birds, drinking some good sake.
That's a new element to your introduction.
Got to change things up. Got to keep people on their toes. I don't want everybody to get too, what do you call it?
Complacent.
Complacent. Yeah, that's right. So, well, here we are on a somewhat chilly winter's evening. The brewing season is in full throttle, I think. Although you might be gearing down, I suppose.
Not yet, unfortunately.
Not quite yet.
By the time this airs, to be fair, I will probably be nursing a hangover because it will be the day after our last motto of the season. Ooh. And the last motto of the season does signal a significant reduction in our workload.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the beginning of the end of the season, if you will.
An ominous way to put it. So when the moto season ends, when your last moto is done, are you done or do you like do other stuff until the last batch is pressed and bottled and all of that? Or how does that work?
When we obviously mash the last batch, we still have about a month where we have to, well, actually it can be sheets 40 days where we still have to look after that and all the other ones. But what will happen is our motobot is filled with about 18 to 20 tanks at any given time. Every 2 days or so, one will disappear and it will not be replaced. So once, our workload gets lighter, but obviously once the last tanks are gone, then yes, I will get moved somewhere else.
Okay.
And I'm hoping, like I did last year, it will be the Muro because it's the most fascinating place to be when you're at Kenbishi, because it's just an incredible way they make koji.
Fantastic. Very cool. Well, fingers crossed. Maybe we'll get some reports from inside the Muro, Kenbishi's massive futakoji production center. So, speaking of Kenbishi, Kenbishi's a fantastic traditional kind of sake. It's in Nara, which I think we all know is the birthplace of sake, isn't it, Andy?
I was wondering where the segue was going to come in. Yeah. If you change your pronunciation just slightly to Nara, then you might be getting somewhere. But we will discuss that because it is contentious during this episode. And there is the cat out of the bag. That is the topic of tonight's episode. We are going to talk about Nara, not Nada, but I guess the key element to tonight's episode is talk about its claim to being the birthplace of sake.
Yes, so Nara, the ancient capital of Japan, it is still perhaps, I think it has a claim to being one of the most spiritual places. If you're speaking of, I guess, the Buddhist tradition in Japan, it's just absolutely jam-packed with temples and, daibutsu statues and bitey deer. It's actually a wonderful place to visit. If you ever get a chance, I do recommend it. It's a much more sort of laid-back kind of feeling than the very, very nearby Kyoto. So, yes, Nara, the ancient capital of Japan. And all contentiousness aside, it obviously has an incredibly important role in the history of sake, the drink that we all know and love. One, I guess, tricky part is sort of pinning down where to start with that history. And I'm hoping Andy's got some ideas because I kind of am throwing my hands up. How do we want to dig into this particular place and topic, Andy?
Well, obviously, it is such a vast topic, so we can't start at the start and then work our way along. It just take too long.
Yeah.
But I guess, certainly from what I've found and what historians seem to be pointing at, if you go back to when what they call the Nara Jidai, so this is the period, the Nara period, this is what, the 8th century, most of the 8th
Right.
century, about 710 to 794, or I think it is. That was back when it was
Yeah.
called Heijōkyō. Obviously, Nara is a contemporary name for the region. This was the front runner to Heian-kyō, which is today's Kyoto. And as it was the central power in Japan, you have a lot of political advancements that begin there. And one of those was the promotion of rice cultivation. You have a political system that's largely based on the Chinese system. They based it on the Tang political system. And they, like I said, they promoted rice cultivation. And from that, you obviously start getting a lot of rice-based products, one of which, of course, is sake.
It's this sort of, I think, it's a familiar story, right? You have a political center becoming obviously an economic center as well, and rice being that very, I think, key element of Japan's economy for most of its recorded history. The sorts of things that go along with that from almost the very beginning is fermentation and producing sake. And at that point, if we look very early on in the history with, I guess, what we would call the Imperial Palace there in Nara, it was an official thing, right? The brewing of sake. It was not just something that companies did and people, or even what we consider, I guess, what you might call the moonshining of the farmers. In Nara, it was a centralized process that was under the control of, for want of a better word, government ministers. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've mentioned it before on the
Right.
podcast, but the very famous branch of the government, the ruling powers, the Mikinotsukasa,
Right.
this was a part of their political system where they said, okay, you're going to be in charge of brewing sake. Who was consuming this sake? It was mostly for religious purposes, more religious ceremonies. The sake that they were making was not for consumption by the masses. That's going to come a lot later. But it is quite incredible that going back to the 8th century, and you've got such a high level of organization around the brewing of sake.
Yeah. And I think when we're talking about this, basically the records of this are primarily, governmental records having to do with sort of the amounts of rice and the demands for sake for particular rituals. And they had a very specialized system where, like, very different kinds of sake, goshu, were made for different seasons. And this is, I think, really sort of a foundational part of the history of sake, but the stuff they were making was not particularly similar to what we know today. Quite an entirely different process. Obviously, this is, well over 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago. They were doing one ichidan jikomi, right? Just the one stage brewing in clay kame pots. Perhaps even small wooden barrels or buckets, I think we might call them today, what we call koka. It's just a completely different kind of thing that was happening. But that is, I think, what we would stands as the root of Nara's sake function, its history, its role in the production, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that point that you just mentioned, I think you said goshu, that is the, I guess, the starting point where things start to develop towards what we now consider sake, which is seishu. That period, so we've come out of the Nara period and we come into the Heian period, and then from there you've got the Kamakura period. This is what, the 12th, 13th century. From that point up until the Edo period is really this incredibly significant time for the development of sake. So much goes on during that time period that contributes to what we now call seishu. That's what we're going to talk about in the episode, but that is the million-dollar question. Are those developments the foundations of modern seishu? And if they are, does that make one of these players in that time period, because it wasn't just Nara, of course, does that make them the birthplace of sake?
Right. I think, a recurring theme that we've talked about is in past episodes is particularly, I think, from the Edo period onward, is sort of the economic and logistical drivers of technological advancement, right? So, one of the reasons that Itami and then Nara became so popular as sake brewing areas was, logistical connections through waterways and the use of water wheels. But with Nara, it was less about that kind, the technological advancement didn't come about so much through those kinds of, I guess, in bottom up drivers, so much as the idea that because Nara was the center for political and primary and especially religious power, it had an advantage, being the introduction of technological advancements from, the big player on the global stage at that point, China.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the root for a lot of this technology. And I guess we should point out as well, Nara and the sake that was being made in these temples was not the only player in town. There was private enterprises as well going on in mostly in Kyoto, but they split off quite significantly during this period of time, what they call the Muromachi period. And like you just said, it's for other factors, not just technological ones. For instance, there is a massive war happens during this time, the Onin War, which is 1467 to 1477, and that completely desolated Kyoto. The place was burnt to the ground, and with it, a lot of the sake breweries that existed there. This was a different type of sake that was being made. So it does vary, but some of the sources that you will find will put that as the main reason for Nara's ascendancy, is the fact that Kyoto was completely leveled in that during that war.
A compelling argument. I mean, it's hard to compete on the sake brewing stage if you're burnt down. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So what we'll concentrate on then is what Nara sake is, I guess, synonymous for, which is of course soboshu. This
Sobo
is
shoes.
yeah, so this is sake that's being made in Buddhist temples.
Right. Yeah. So we have a large concentration of Buddhist temples in Nara, and they became this center for brewing, that kind of, it was, in fact, I don't think Nara was the only place where monks were brewing sake, but there are just so many of them in such concentration, that it became really synonymous with this Nara area.
Yeah, that is a very good point, because obviously the most famous one of so the most famous example of soboshu, we've already done an entire episode on this, which people call today Bodai Moto. But what we talked about in that episode is actually originally the one that's mentioned in the Goshu no Niki. This is considered the first brewing manual written by ordinary people, is the explanation that you normally get. And that isn't a moto. That is a brand of sake that, like you said before, was actually just made with one addition of ingredients. So it wasn't stage mashed at all. So you can't call it a moto if there's no preceding stages. So it wasn't actually a moto. There was, for example, another type of sake being made, which is amano sake. Or Amanozake, you see both, and that is from a temple exactly the same as Bodai-san. So Bodai-san was named after the place where it came from, Bodai-san Shorakuji, and Amano-san is where Amano-saki was made. And according to one of our favorite books, the Nihonshu no Kitamichi, Horie-san has actually listed the recipe for both of these. And Amano-san is in stages, and it does look like it's kind of getting closer to that modern definition of sake, and it looks more advanced on paper anyway than the Bodai equivalent. But I guess where the real difference would have come in is behind the scenes, they are starting to get close to making a Moto. So you would imagine that although Bodai-san isn't in stages, probably more consistent, they probably had less spoilage because they were starting to flirt around discovering the usage of lactic acid, or lactic acid bacteria that makes lactic acid. So that is a significant step in the journey towards Seishu.
And I think this is an excellent illustration of what I like to think of as one of the great sort of confusions about all of this conversation over, who started what and where started. Like there's no switch. There's no like on off. There are all of these little advancements happening all over the place, and some of them are happening in different orders, and some of them are they find one thing that's really good, but everything else is a failure, so nobody remembers it. Everybody's finding their own pieces of the puzzle that will eventually become something that we know today. And yeah, Amano-sake, they were making advancements in multi-stage mash building. While, Bodai-san, they were making advancements in the usage of lactic acid bacteria for a stabler fermentation. And eventually those pieces would fall together and make a big change in that stability, right? So it's not like, there was one person or one temple or one group that was doing everything. Lots of people were doing different things, right? So yeah, we've got here the advancements that I think people are probably relatively familiar with already. We've got the idea of the Bodai-san establishment. We've got the idea of multi-stage mashing coming in. Can you give us some ideas of other advancements that were coming along?
Yeah, I think to do that, you just have to first think about what we mean by seishu and then kind of work our way back. So obviously the modern definition of seishu incorporates quite a lot of things, that the solids and the liquids must be separated. The we know now that the reason that they eventually insisted on that was for tax purposes, because they wanted to stop Doboroku being a thing. So they insisted on this one stage because they knew that that requires a significant investment of machinery, and that would really separate people that were moonshining and the people that were actually invested in being professional brewers. Obviously, nowadays we think Nihonshu, we do think of Dankake or Sandanjikomi. It's actually not Sandanjikomi. I don't know why everyone says that. It's stage mashing rather than three-stage mashing. A lot of breweries don't do three-stage mashing. They do four, and sometimes more than that. So yeah, stage mashing, and then I guess the other one would be, of course, the Moto, which takes us back to where we were 2 minutes ago, talking about Bodai-san.
So yeah, and I think the rice polishing is actually one thing that kind of stands out in the story of Narasake, because that ends up being really sort of a defining part of this early history. We don't have a lot of detailed records of the very earliest processes, but one thing that we do know is that for a long time, the rice that was used for making sake, part of it was polished and part of it was not. And the balance of that was, various styles of sake would use different ratios of polished to unpolished rice. And, the koji would be polished or sometimes even unpolished. And what we see happening in Nara is they began using polished rice, what is often simply called white rice, hakumai, for all of the fermentation from the koji to the mashing. And that is what became known as morohaku. So that process, that first sort of use of that really kind of became a foundation for later brewing developments, right? So I think we can say that the use of all polished rice for the brewing of sake started in Nara and became a kind of through current defining future developments of sake.
Yeah, this was hugely significant because you can try these kind of sakes nowadays that are made with unpolished rice. There's a brewery does one with genmai, for example.
Yeah.
And then you try one made from hakumai, from white rice, and they're completely different. So this is, the significance of this cannot be underestimated. Like you said, they go from a part of the rice would have been polished, and then part of it would have been genmai. So the, believe it or not, the koji was the genmai part, and the kakimai would have been the white rice part. I got that right, did I? I always get that
so,
mixed up.
Yeah, you know, and I think you did. And this is always one of the things that sort of bothered me about this history is because, like, how did they do that? Like, you know, nowadays, I think one of the big problems with making sake using genmai is getting koji to grow on genmai. I assume at the very least, they have to kind of break the hulls a bit. Like, I don't know how it works. But yes, sort of the records I have seen have said, yes, the koji was genmai and the kakemai was hakumai, which yeah. Seems really counterintuitive.
I can never figure that out. It seems like if they'd done the opposite, it would have been so much easier. But I can't imagine how you make koji with genmai either. It, you know, the whole premise of making koji that you want these spores, the haze, to penetrate, and that is why you have to, there's all the faffing around with washing the rice and soaking the rice and what have you, steaming the rice, etc. That part of the sake brewing process is all preparatory for making koji. Yeah, it just seems that they maybe didn't figure that part out as good as they could have done, but that is the way it was. They called that katahaku. Kata is the kanji for, you sometimes see it for like one way. So I guess in that sense that they're meaning that part of it is polished and part of it was unpolished. And then you have this incredible breakthrough with a morohaku where both the koji and the kakimai are polished, which is of course how they do it today. And that always fascinates me when you think about, as a consumer back then, when a yeah. new sake came out, it was really significant. You would be drinking something that tasted completely different from that previous version that brewers had come up with. Whereas nowadays, that kind of step change is very unlikely that that's ever going to happen again. But back then, I guess they had that pleasure of being able to experience these incredible step changes. And morohaku, you could almost say it's one of the most significant steps that they made in sake brewing, full stop, because now we really are into getting very close to the kind of refinement that characterizes modern day seishu.
Right. And I think, yeah, that's probably a good way to bring out that refinement, because this is a term that comes up quite a lot in discussing this history and, you know, what it actually means to say refined sake. Obviously, morohaku is going to be a bit more refined than katahaku. And what are some other ways that Nara sake became more refined?
So just finish on morohaku. That is first mentioned in a book, or a diary, sorry, I should say, that we've mentioned throughout this podcast since we started doing it. It's a very significant historical record called the Tamoin no Niki. It is a log from a temple that is the main temple. So Shorakuji is a sub-temple of another temple that anyone who's been to Nara is most likely going to have seen. You can't miss it. It's a Kofukuji. And if you've been to Nara Park, it's the one with the five-story pagoda. So this These records were kept for over 100 years. I think 1478 to 1618, this incredible resource was kept by some of the monks. I think there was about three authors. And round about the end of the 16th century, so about 1570, I think, the journals from there's a lot of mentions to sake brewing. And Morohaku is mentioned for the first time. There's other things get mentioned in this document, which is why it is so significant for brewing history. So three-stage mashing is mentioned here. So we can probably extrapolate from that three-stage mashing has now developed by this point. This is the end of the 16th century. We're about to go into the Edo period. So they figured out that three-stage mashing is advantageous, which means a couple of things actually. They've started to figure out how to brew with larger tanks because three-stage mashing is not required from kame. So that is one of the big differences from brewing in kame and brewing in these wooden vats, as the three-stage mashing becomes a necessity because obviously everything, the amount of rice and the amount of koji and the amount of water is getting much bigger, and you can't just put huge amounts of these ingredients together or you'll overwhelm everything. The other element to that is most likely they've started to probably figure out the advantages to brewing in cold weather. For example, Bodai-san that we mentioned before, the Bodai-Moto method is a warm weather method. It was for brewing in warmer weather. It's conducive to brewing in warmer weather. Whereas three-stage mashing is a bit more conducive for winter brewing. And as we start to get into the later periods, it starts to shift in popularity from consumers, from preferring these warmer brewed varieties, shifting more towards those that are brewed in colder weather. So that mention of three-stage mashing is a good indicator of what's actually going on in breweries at the time.
Right. And I think what we're seeing with this, like when as we're making more sake and as these sort of advancements are happening, as Andy sort of offhandedly mentioned, Bodai-san was a brand, and that I think indicates that sake has started to become much more of a consumer product. And when you're making sake in larger volumes and making sake for outside consumption rather than just for rituals or for the palace, you're going to have to start also thinking a little bit more about shelf life. And this is an interesting thing that I think you've probably heard about this before if you're a sake drinker and sake fan, but I think is still probably surprising to a lot of people. And then we're talking about what the 14th century, 1300s, and they were already pasteurizing stuff. Pasteurizing, let's say they were heat treating their sake. They were heating it to a point where microorganisms could not survive as well. I don't think we can go so far as to say they were sterilizing it. They were large scale disinfecting their sake to improve shelf life stability for a consumer product, which again, I think when you're the end consumer and you're getting stuff that's less likely to be spoiled and unpleasant, that's another sense of, a big change, a positive change in this thing that you've been consuming. Just an absolutely massive achievement if you think about the time, because, in Europe, they weren't doing that until the 19th century, right? Louis Pasteur, was that the 1840s?
Yeah, I mean, it was hundreds of years after Japan have their records of doing this. Of course, as we've said before, most likely this technology comes from China. We always make that leap that because Japan was doing it years before that they must have invented it, but that is not what the experts say on that subject.
Well, I'm sure some of the experts are probably willing to dispute that, National pride does come to play in some of these, but yeah, I think it's a safe assumption. But like, there's just so much more going on the Chinese side of the Sea of Japan.
But I love when you mentioned the consumerism part, because it's fascinating the developments that are happening from the consumer aspect at that time. Like we said at the beginning, before, when Nara is the capital, when it back when it is the front runner to Heian-kyo, the sake that's being made at these this government institution that's been founded and set up to brewing, that was not intended for consumerism, but we are about to come into this age of consumerism in sake, and we see these little incremental steps getting towards that. So, like I said, we've said many times, Bodai San was a brand, Sobo Shu, Temple Brewing were not the only people to be on that bandwagon. In fact, the first brand wasn't a Sobo Shu, it was from Kyoto. It was made by a company called Yanagi, and or sorry, that was the brand name, and it was called Yanagi Sake. And that was wildly popular as well. That would have been a rival for Sobo Shu, but for the reasons that we mentioned, Temple Brewing just become so much more advanced and way surpass what was being made in places in Kyoto. But you do see these brands emerging, and we start to hear of sake that's making it being distributed much wider than its area where it was made. And of course, that leads us into the next stage, where we get into the Edo period, where consumerism flourishes, and sake is a very big part of that.
Right. Yeah. And we've seen this. Like we've seen how all of these steps that lead into sake's sort of, I guess, industrial revolution of the thing, they're being built right here. The whole idea of, developing for a more stable product, a more predictable product, a product that can be distributed. I think, we there are advancements in packaging where, obviously at the start, they were just making it and selling it, I guess, by the kame. They probably weren't even using barrels yet. They were still using ceramic tanks, jars that we would have discussed in the last episode of brewing things. But then, obviously, if people are going to be drinking it at home, they're not going to be taking a whole kame with them. So that's where we start seeing these more commercialized, smaller bottles. They would have been ceramic Tokuri at the time. So right, I think this is the start. This is the foundation of sake as a consumer product, which is probably a pretty good argument for Nara being the origin place of sake, as we know it today. But like I said, that's a pretty contentious sort of statement for every sake brewing region in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, it is telling that Morohaku was a very strong brand. We should point that out. They called it Nanto Morohaku. Nanto is another way of saying Nara. It literally means South Capital. So that was a brand. You've got classifications behind that brand. So we all like a moan about the classification system nowadays of Tokutei Mei Shoshu. But if you look back, there are parallels that can be made. There was effectively three, four grades at that time. You're talking Morohaku at the top, and then Doburoku at the bottom, and then you've got completely unpolished rice being used for sake. That was also a classification. And then you have Katahaku, which is, I guess, that would be the equivalent of your Junmais and your Honjozos today. They're not quite Ginjo level, but they would have still been considered premium because they're a lot higher up than Doburoku and, sake made from completely unpolished rice. So yeah, there's so many parallels that we can make with classifications and brandings. And obviously, if you look at what followed that, when you start getting into the regions now of northern Osaka and Hyogo Prefecture that were so dominant during the Edo period, some of which continue to be dominant into the current day, you have usages of those names. So the next big thing would have been Itami Morohaku. And as you know, Jim, I think we're going to get into the contentious part now. They are a rival, claimant as a birthplace of sake. There are a few of these places. I mean, if you want to take the if you want to take the serious contenders, there's, as far as I can make out, there's four that you often hear, maybe three if you eliminate Hyogo, because their claim is very strenuous. The Harima Fudoki, it pure and simply is just based on a mythical tale. I think it's a mother that gives birth to a boy, but there's no father, and she calls on the gods to brew sake, and they make sake, and the baby takes it to certain people, and that's how they identify the father or something. It's a very, I haven't really read the whole thing, but that is the basis for the Harima region being the birthplace of sake we've talked about before. And I think we should probably maybe do a whole episode on the Shimane's specific claim to being the birthplace of sake. But Shimane is obviously one of the more vocal regions who claim to be the birthplace of sake. But again, it is based, I mean, it's about a eight-headed serpent. So that should, with your critical faculties working, set off a couple of alarm bells straight away as to that particular claim. But when you get to Nara and Itami, then it does start to get quite subjective.
Right. I mean, we've got, you know, I think if we just look at the establishment of a scale production, I don't want to say industrial scale production, but a scaled production of a consumer beverage of fermented from rice, it seems pretty solid to call Nara the most, I think, likely origin point, if you want to set an origin point. Like, I think it's all going to come down to how you sort of define what we talk about when we say, oh, the origin of sake or the origin of seishu or whatever. And I think it's going to come down to, you know, how pedantic you want to be about any specific element. But I mean, the pieces are all pretty solid, I think. We've got technological advancements in production leading to a stable, popular product that didn't exist before. Like, there was just, it didn't happen before Nara, or at least, you know, that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. But we should maybe just explain then what the big difference in these two claims are between Itami and Nara. So it isn't actually Itami that claims to be the birthplace of sake. It is now modern day Itami, but at the time, this is the beginning of the Edo period, it was a place called Konoike, and there is a stone plaque that stands today, and it says that they're the birthplace of Nihonshu, I think is what it says. The one in Shorakuji says, or sorry, Seishu, I should say. So the plaque in Konoike claims to be the birthplace of Seishu. The only difference between that and the one in Shorakuji is the one in Shorakuji specifies Japanese Seishu. So it literally says Nihon Seishu no Hattenchi, whereas the other one doesn't have the Japan part in that. But their respective claims, Nara's rests on what we just mentioned, specifically the things, these 4 points that are written in the Tamoin no Niki about three-stage massing, pressing, hire, and the origin of moto, so bodai moto. Itami, on the other hand, they claim to be because they were the first to do clear sake. This is sumizake. And that is a different process that they're referring to. They are talking about ash filtration. There's all kinds of anecdotal tales of a disgruntled member of staff at a brewery in Konoike threw some ash into a batch of sake to try and get back at his, you know, overly harsh employer. And the next day, rather than spoiling, they actually had clear sake. And that is how they discovered seishu. But technically, as we all know, filtration is not a requirement of seishu, whereas pressing is. You cannot call it Seishu if it isn't pressed. So I'm going to be the first to put my cards on the table and say that point there specifically is why I think Nara's case is a lot stronger than Itami's. Itami also say, though, that they commercialized sake, the brewing industry, to an unprecedented level. They were the first people to ship sake to Edo, for example. This was on pack horse, and then this is, I believe, in 1600, the very first year of the 17th century. They'd already started to send sake to Edo. And actually, the families that were doing this, it's actually quite an interesting history as well, which we don't have time to get into today, but these families became the zaibatsu in Japan. The zaibatsu means these are these big businesses that were typically into banking, money distribution, rice distribution, the very wealthy merchants of the Edo period, and also a lot of them were into sake brewing. But they sent sake first to Edo, and that started this burst of consumerism, and therefore that is part of their claim as well, that they are the ones that brought brewing to a much bigger scale, an industrial scale. I mentioned on the previous episode, they sometimes call this the sake's industrial revolution, and they were doing it with clear sake, so it was filtered sake, and therefore they are the birthplace of Seishu.
And just sort of like, I think to clarify, right? So we've got two different things. So the pressing is obviously the just this the splitting of sake into the liquid and solids, right? So the leftover rice. Whereas by filtration, what we mean is clarifying. What you do, I guess I don't remember what the term is in beer, but you add some kind of agent to a liquid to cause the sort of cloudiness, the proteins and whatever, the very small dissolved particles to settle down to the bottom, and that's that major difference. And one of the things that sort of has always been kind of standing at the back of the mind is when filtration really became, or when pressing, I guess what we call pressing, the joso, the removal of the liquid from the lees, when that became a real thing. Because obviously mechanically, like setting up big presses and stuff, we don't have any records of that, of when that was really happening. Anyone could have, say, strained sake through a piece of cloth and separated out the liquid from the lees. But at the industrial scale, at the sort of the or I guess the commercial or larger scale pre-drinking element, when that came into being, we don't really have, I personally haven't been able to find any documentary record of when or where that came in, except that I did read somewhere that, or not somewhere, it's a book called Maboroshi no Koshu, that in Toyotomi's age, right, Hideyoshi's age, they were pressing sake using a fune, which I think most of our listeners will know what that is, right? It's the box press. So it's an old process, but where did it start? When did it start? Nobody really seems to know.
Yeah, most likely there isn't a record for it. And you're absolutely right. The source that you're likely to find if you start investigating this is a book, a very famous book from the Edo period that I'm always nervous about doing this in front of a translator, but I guess they would translate it as the Mountains and Oceans of Japan, or Pictures of the Mountains and Oceans
Oh,
of
the picture
Japan.
book.
Yeah, so it is a picture book. It was a very popular picture book during the Edo period. It was a bestseller. And there is a whole section on breweries from Itami, and you can quite clearly see fune shibori. So this is, like you just said, this is pressing. I guess the method before the modern method nowadays, using these accordion-like presses, most famously the Yabuta. Although that's just a brand, there are several other alternatives, but you kind of pressurize it from the top. So you're putting sake in bags, laying them flat, and then you're basically squeezing them with pressure. And you can see that depicted in this book, but that is from the end of the 18th century, 1797. So if the when did that begin? Yeah, you're right. There doesn't seem, or I couldn't find one either, that there was a solid source. What you do see in almost all the sources is they mention that it is noted in the Tamawin Nonnikki.
So I haven't actually read the Tamawin Nunnuku in any kind of version. What does it say? Like, how? What is? Does it get into detail to how they're doing it? Does it like? Is it fune? Is it or is it like drip pressing?
Maybe we leave this because I can't find anything either, Jim. And I have to admit, I was tempted to buy a copy of the Tamawin Nonnikki, but I can't even find which part it's in. I did try this a while ago when I was going through my buying old book stage, and there's so many of them, and I'm not going to spend like 4,000 yen. To then find that I've got the wrong volume and
Gamble.
be hearing about, I don't know, making how to make baskets or something. So yeah, I think we
All
just
right.
have to leave it at that. That
Right. So, yeah, I think at heart, even sort of the random Seishu Doburoku conversations that do pop up in regards to Nara, we'll just leave those aside and say, hey, listen, they've got pasteurization, they've got Morohaku, they've got the bottling, or they've got sort of small scales, they've got branding. I think it's a pretty good argument to say that it's a significant origin point for the modern conception of sake.
right. Well, as we're sort of running out of time, I will have to put you on the take you off the fence then, Jim. Are
Okay.
you saying you agree with me as well? Do you consider Nara to be the birthplace of sake?
You know what? I'm actually this isn't me vacillating. I don't think there is a birthplace of sake. I think Nara is a major developmental turning point in the history of sake that could easily be defined as the most important origin point. But, if it's all going to depend on how you want to define your points.
Yeah, that's a much better answer than mine. But I'll live with my first choice. I think if I have to pick one, I'll say Nara for that reason, that or the defining characteristic of modern Seishu is the separation of lees and liquids, and that seems to have happened in Nara, on top of all these other things. When I think of stage mashing, is a very important part in contemporary brewing, as is pasteurizing or not pasteurizing. It's a choice nowadays, but it's still a major development, and certainly enabled sake to be distributed a what wider place. So from all the claimants to this, I think Nara's. How about this? I think Nara's is the strongest case.
I think that's probably a good argument. Not as case is the strongest to be the. And you know what? And I think that's probably our takeaway. Not
Yeah.
as case is the strongest for being the origin of Seishu, modern sake.
Yeah, that's a good place to
That's
finish, I think.
all right. So here's the important part, Andy. What's your recommendation this time?
This probably won't surprise you because I think we bought a bottle of this at round about the same time. I might be making that up. You'll have to tell me. But I'm going to go. It's no surprise that I'm a big fan of this brewery, but I'm going to go for Takacho from Yucho Shuzo. That is a sake that the motto came from Bodai-san Shorakuji. Every year they have an event where they try and replicate the recipe from the Goshu no Nikki, and they all make a batch, and I believe it's altered quite significantly for modern times, but it still produces that very lactic notes that are the characteristics of Bodai Moto, or a very common thread in Bodai Moto. And I think that that is probably going to be quite close to the sake that would have been made back then. It is quite cloying, I would say, probably quite too cloying for some, very high in acidity. It has really lactic notes to the point of being yogurt-like, but I loved it. And it's one of the bottles in my many that I've tried where it kind of took me back and I thought, wow, that is a sake that shows the diversity that is possible in sake brewing. So Yucho Shuzo, they are a fantastic brewery for experimenting with these old styles, but they also do a very modern style, which is what they're famous for, which is Kazenomori. So I'm a big fan of their brewery and I love Takacho.
Absolutely. I think there was a real risk of you choosing one from you chose Yuzo and me choosing another, but I was careful about that. We did in fact buy a bottle of that Takacho around about the same time. Wonderful stuff. But I am going to go for another Nara brewery that I think they do really, really great things. Kubo Honke Shuzo. Kubo Honke. They make really cool stuff like a Kimoto Doburoku, but that's the one that I like is their Kimoto Junmai Jukusei, their aged Kimoto Junmai sake. It's got this really nice sort of, it's a spiral label, right? So it's cut, it's like a strip that wraps around the bottle three times, and it's sort of written on the sort of the times. But I have to admit, I don't know how to read this kanji. The name means sleeping dragon, but I don't know what it is. But it's, I mean, it's that kind of, there's this, I have this feeling that Nara sake is really hefty and rich. But, it's got that depth to it. It's got that Kimoto to it. It's got that Jukusei to it. Everything that hits all the buttons for sake that I love.
So I hope the fact that the owner of that brewery sent you that sake for free isn't affecting your recommendation for tonight, Jim.
Oh, it's not at all. And he didn't only do that, he sent me his book for free as well.
Wow.
I sent me
Okay.
I sent him my book too. So
Yeah, I'm sure it is a lovely
no.
sake. We'll
It
leave
is
the
a lovely sake.
little
It's really just it's got that oomph to it, that kick to it that I enjoy. I did enjoy it quite a lot.
Yeah. Should point out as well that that brewery is very famous for kansake. A lot of people choose to warm that sake. It's actually quite popular in the town I live in as well. So
I don't know that I would drink it any other way, honestly.
brilliant.
But that's just me. I've been called peculiar by sake brewers before for trying everything.
I'd take that as a compliment, Jim.
Right. All right. So I think that brings us to the end of another sake deep dive. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I want to thank all of our Patreon patrons for their support. It really does make doing this podcast an easier prospect. It helps us keep us going. And if you are not yet a Patreon supporter, our Patreon is up, patreon.com/sakedeepdive, all one word. We're in 2024. It is, gosh, we've got two of our sake matsuri behind us. So this year is going to be our third one. Every Patreon supporter does get an invitation to our online sake matsuri, where you get to come and have a drink over Zoom with Andy and I, and listen to us do our thing. So please do consider. So I hope everyone has enjoyed, and I have been, as always, your host, Jim Ryan. You can find me online at my website, www.jimryan.com. That's JimRion, where you can, I've started blogging again after a long absence. So you can read me ramble on. You can find out about my book, Discovering Yamaguchi Sake, which is still out there on shelves and online. Andrew, where can people find you?
As usual, at my website, www.originsake.com, and from there is links to my social media, or I guess it's just Instagram these days. But yeah, that would be the way to get hold of me.
So, I hope everybody stays warm in this chilly winter season. Keep your tokuri full, but drink responsibly. And kanpai!
Kanpai.